So I'll be doing the Bible reading tonight. There's actually two passages. So the first one is John 1, verses 1 to 3, and the second one is Job 38, verses 31 to 33. But we'll go to John 1 first. So John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. And now Job 38, verses 31 to 33. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades, or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season, or can you guide the bear with its children? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on the earth?
Good afternoon, church. Hi. This is fun. This is my second ever sermon. Don't applaud, because you guys are getting the best one. You're getting my retirement sermon. I'd promised that I was only going to do this one thing and only on this one topic. I had to promise that to my wife very clearly, that I was not going to go to Morling now, that I was not going to become a pastor. This morning, I thought I spoke for about 15 minutes. I think it was more like 40, so I'm going to try and fly through a little bit quicker this afternoon so we can all have some yummy food afterwards. Before we do jump in, I'll just quickly pray, because Lord knows I need help. Heavenly Father, you are... you are almighty, you are massive. As we just heard in Job, when you were talking to Job, you created the stars, you set them in motion, you created everything. Who are we to doubt you? Father, as we look at this topic of science and faith and all its complexities and challenges, Lord, I just ask that you would give a bit of clarity to it, give me some clear words. But just as we talk to friends and family about this topic, that we would just be open and warm and listening. If we don't understand things, God, just guide us and give us more opportunities when we do know more things. Amen. Okay, so this morning was my first ever message, but to be strictly correct, it wasn't actually the first sermon that I'd ever written. When I was seven in 1993, my parents went to Africa for 3 weeks, and as some kind of bizarre homework, they gave me to write a sermon. My dad was a pastor, so it seemed like a natural kind of thing to do. They suggested I write a sermon about not worrying, because they'll be away, and I was 7 years old. You know that passage in Matthew 6, do not worry. I think I wrote about a page, like three paragraphs. Totally nailed it. And then I decided that I was never, ever going to be a pastor. I thought maths and science and Ace Ventura, that was more my cup of tea. A few years later, when I was in Year 7 here at good old Penno High, we had to do a 5-minute science talk, and I chose the small scientific issue of science and creation. I spoke for like 15 minutes on the second law of thermodynamics and increasing complexity of organic life. But in the end, it was all irrelevant anyway, because the answer was clearly in the Bible, that God created everything, just like we heard in John 1:1. I'm not mentioning this to say that I'm a smart guy. I'm just letting you know that I was a weird kid. and and started reading about this stuff pretty early in life. So when Andrew asked if I would talk on this, after I finished kind of laughing at him, I thought about it a bit more and went, well, I've been reading about this stuff for about 20 years, so why not? Okay, what is this stuff? What is science and faith? I'm just going to run through a quick ground rules for this message. This isn't about being smart, as much as science seems to be that way. It's really not. To me, it's just another aspect of human experience. It's, you know, it's like art, it's like music, it's like Ace Ventura. I'm not an expert, but I highly recommend John Lennox. Has everyone heard of John Lennox? A few hands, a few shakes. John Lennox is an Irish dude. He's getting on now. He's probably close to 80. I think he's in his 70s now. He's a professor of mathematics at Oxford. He's a philosopher of science, but he very clearly and with a lot of warmth just unpacks Christian apologetics for people. He's kind of like the modern-day C.S. Lewis, but in science land, not literary land. John actually was not a student of C.S. Lewis, but he used to listen to his lectures at Cambridge back in the day, which was pretty cool. This is a massive, massive, massive topic. It, you know, covers atheism, you know, creation, evolution, philosophy, logic, proof, truth. So naturally, I'm just going to wrap all that up nicely in the next 20 minutes. I won't. I'm just going to run through a few high-level ideas, but I just wanted to say it's a huge area. It can cause a lot of confusion, but don't worry, it does for everyone in the whole planet. It's that kind of topic. And the other point to keep in mind with this is that sometimes it is used quite aggressively by people. It can kind of stir up a lot of vitriol, particularly by people who are just wanting any reason to put down Christianity or any notion of God. So if you ever find yourself in discussion with people about this topic, like I prayed God for help for, just be warm, listen really hard. If you don't know anything, just say, please, I don't understand. But then you get the opportunity to say that I would love to find out more for you. Let me go away, find out some more things and come back. I think that's a good response. Don't come to me for the really curly science questions, though. Goals for today. One, just to provide a bit of encouragement for all of us. So just a bit of a boost to our faith that this is actually a topic that we can get some inroads in. And then the second one, hopefully, just to give you some ideas, some opinions, some resources to help equip us as disciples in Thornleigh, in Sydney, in Australia, just in the culture that we're in. If we're serious about engaging with the world on Jesus, then I think it does help to have just a little bit of understanding about what the kind of current climate is with all of this science-y stuff. It does seem to have a real kind of cultural authority to it in this day and age. So what is it? What is science? What is faith? Let's start with science. Plain old definitions. Science is simply just the intellectual act of observing the natural world, putting forward predictions, systematic tests about the behaviour of stuff and things, so that humanity can build up a big book of knowledge about what the universe is made of and how it all works. It may talk of laws and rules, but at the end of the day, science is descriptive. It's just descriptions of the natural things and stuff. Faith, I think, can be just as easy to define from one point of view. As far as I can tell, faith is simply just choosing to believe upon weighing up evidence. I don't know when it first came about, but this idea that faith means just blindly putting your trust in something that you can't see without any evidence, I think it's an unhelpful view of what faith actually is. It's certainly not, you know, my experience of Christian faith. There just has to be evidence when you decide to do something, doesn't there? I know that my wife loves me, despite my best efforts to frustrate her. but do I have proof that she does? I can't give you formula. I can't give you a certificate that says, yep, she 100% loves me. But I would bet my life on it. I have enough evidence to completely trust a decision that I have faith that she does love me. I would even say that extreme atheists, they have faith. They have a decision that they make, and they weigh up the evidence that they see fit to make that happen. Yet, to many in Australia and across the world, the word faith just immediately conjures up this irrational belief based on a vague kind of spiritual conviction rather than any evidence. So superficially it seems then that they are, you know, separate things, that the modern conflict between these two areas is down to the rationality of science versus this irrationality of placing some kind of hope in a God, if there is one. If that's the case then, surely there wouldn't be such a thing as a respected scientist who also happens to be a God-believing, fearing Christian. A really quick counterpoint to that is, if you look at the list of Nobel Prize winners the last 118 years or so, more than 60% of them are believers in God. These are the top scientists in their field. These are really clever, rational, respected people. Yet, more than half of them have a belief and a faith in God. So, clearly, these two can play quite nicely together. So it's almost kind of case closed. I'd like to finish the sermon now and then go and eat some yummy food. But we'll press on. We're going to go a bit deeper. And then we're going to go a bit deeper again. We're going to go Inception style. So hang on. Okay, so science and faith. This wouldn't be a talk on science without a fun Venn diagram. Sometimes it feels like we have this scenario where we've got science and faith kind of just wrestling, tugging, and our job as Christians is to find this kind of middle ground somewhere that we can make these two play nice. That seems to be the general kind of perception that's out there. But I want to put it to you guys that we need to zoom out from that way of thinking entirely. We need to see that trying to make God work between these two circles just is the wrong way of even thinking about this. The reality is that God exists beyond the surface that these diagrams are even drawn on. We need to look at it this way, that God is the actual picture, the whole canvas that science and faith sit on. I would argue that the only reason we can do science is because we have a God behind it. In this illustration, God is the blackboard. God is the room, the universe that exists wherever this is. And science and faith are a part of that. But the bigger backdrop, it's God. It just has to be. We're going to go a little bit deeper. Going deeper than the actual dictionary definitions and coming up with this rational, irrational version, the current cultural conflict on this topic, science and faith, actually comes down to two different worldviews, two different ways of looking at things. These lenses, broadly speaking, are what's known as naturalism and theism, a big N and a big T. And they're very separate things, apparently. Naturalism says that the universe is all that exists. That's it. It's just the stuff and the things, which is called mass and energy. Theism, on the other hand, says that the universe is not all that exists, that ultimate reality is God. Naturalism would say that ultimate reality is whatever the ultimate laws and rules are that govern the stuff and the things. Naturalism would say that the universe gives no evidence for God. But theism says that there's plenty of evidence for God. So how do we navigate this one? Where does science fit in between these two worldviews? I think it's helpful to remember that it wasn't always the question the way that it's phrased now. If we go back kind of 300, 400, 500 years ago, some of the brightest thinkers in the world, and they still are, like these guys were proper geniuses, they were actually driven by a desire to understand how God had designed the universe. Guys like Galileo, Kepler, Isaac Newton, who's probably like the bee's knees, Isaac Newton. These guys were next level geniuses, but the kind of evidence that their discoveries gave them pointed back to God. They marvelled at the Creator when they discovered these things. Newton, for instance, so he discovered the very first kind of incarnation of the law of gravity. Massive achievement, very smart guy. He didn't do that and then go, aha, okay, now I understand about the planets and the motion. We don't need God for that part. He actually said, what a marvelous God that did it that way. It's not something that you would kind of hear about first when you think of Isaac Newton, the apple, the law of gravity. But this is true. He looked at the description of the universe. He had a mathematical model that made sense. And he went, aha, wow, how clever for our God to have designed it the way that he did. Fast forward to now, it's kind of the opposite view. Because we understand so much about physics and chemistry in such great detail, it means that there just isn't a need for God. Everything is just about explained, apparently. At my work, I work at quite a tech-heavy company. There's a lot of nerds, a lot of geeks. On Slack, you're familiar with Slack? It's like the cool company, Skype. No, Nico's given me. It's like the old MSN days. Yeah, just chats. All right, so I created a channel a few months back for hashtag life questions, just for anyone to throw up some curly things, see what kind of discussion happened. I partly did that so that, fast forward to this week, I could ask the question, hey guys, I'm giving a talk on faith and science. What do you guys think about this? Any ideas? And one of the main views that kind of bubbled forward out of the ideas there was this idea that everything's explained, so why do we even need God? Fine for you guys to have your Christianity, have God, but it just didn't make sense why you would want to do that. One girl actually said, when I said that, you know, we as Christians actually agree with a lot of science, like we'd have to be idiots not to, but she said, well, okay, well, if you've already got a perfectly good explanation then in science, you just tack God on at the end because you feel like it. And, you know, we kind of left it there, but I'd be keen to follow that thread through with her a bit more. But it is true that science has explained a whole lot of stuff, but you've got to think about explanation in two different levels. There's different kinds of explanation. They're both valid. We need to consider them both, and one of them's actually kind of more important, I think. So I want to do an experiment, a thought experiment. So this kettle boiling, if I was to ask you why is that kettle boiling in, you know, a framework of science, you would probably say something like, well, there's this flow of electron holes in this resistive element which causes heat, and that causes the atomic jiggling of the water molecules to increase, and so on and so on and so on. That's true, sure, but I say, no, that's not the reason at all why the kettle is boiling. The kettle's boiling because I have man flu and I just want a cup of tea. That's why the kettle is boiling. So it's kind of funny, we laugh at that, but they're both very valid, equal explanations of what's going on there. They're just different kinds of explanation. And if we're thinking about this example beyond anything than the physics involved with it, the more important explanation is the why explanation. It involves the desire behind it, the volition, that there was an agent that caused that to happen. John Lennox gives a really good example about the internal combustion engine of a car. It's kind of like saying, because we understand in great detail how the combustion engine works, we've totally explained how that car came to be. When, you know, Henry Ford was the reason why the car came to be. They're not competing explanations, they're just different kinds of explanations. And I think we really need to have both when we're looking at the universe. Why is it even here? All right, let's go a little bit deeper. There's some big ugly words in here. The rational intelligibility of the universe, and that we can think, reason, deduce, and understand the universe points to intelligent designer. What does this mean? What is this argument? Okay, so naturalism, if we follow naturalism through, all that there is stuff and things, mass and energy. Follow that to its logical conclusion. You get to this idea called reductionism, which is the view that everything, including us, including humans, we're a very complex interaction of cells, chemicals, atoms, energy. We've got a clever computing machine in our heads called a brain. But that's it. It's just reducible to that kind of mechanistic level. The thing I want to point out here is, if that's the case, if naturalism is all there is, we can reduce everything, how can we even do science then? How can we trust what our brain is telling us? If it's just the result of this kind of mindless, unguided process, you can't then have a scientific statement. Darwin, actually, of all people, Charles Darwin, he cottoned on to this himself. It's kind of famously called Darwin's Doubt. He said that, basically that exact idea, if we are just this, you know, evolutionary process, he kind of leaves out the part of how it all initially kicked into gear, what created it from nothing. But if we're the result of this process, how can we trust our own thoughts? And it wasn't resolved. He had that doubt his whole life. And no one's really got a good answer for it that makes sense. So in a way, it kind of undermines the very foundation of science if you reduce everything to that kind of level. And the second point there, that we can even think, reason, deduce, understand the universe for ourselves and have it have any meaning, is a huge pointer, I think, that maybe it was designed intelligently. If we're able to make sense of our own deductions, our own thoughts, doesn't it make sense then that it isn't just chance and fluke, that perhaps it was designed intelligently by a designer? That's a whole kind of topic in and of itself, so I'm just going to gloss over that one. If you want to talk through that one in more detail, come and grab me, because there's a lot of good books. And C.S. Lewis himself, actually, in his kind of conversion, his testimony, he was thinking along these lines for how good and evil, if there's any idea of good and evil at all, it must be because there's an initial designer. But we'll gloss over that one. Okay, science is great, but the first part of that, science is great. I love it. I know a lot of you guys love it too. But I want to kind of bring it down a peg as well. I didn't set out in this talk to poke at science and try and find holes in it. But I do want to say that scientists are people, just like you and me. And even the very best ones make mistakes and say weird things, particularly when you remove them from their specialty, their science. They just get things wrong. And the second idea about this that I'll come to in a second is science just doesn't have all the answers anyway, despite the claims that it does. So science is done by scientists. Okay, what do I mean? So Stephen Hawking, he's a brilliant guy. Like, this guy, to continue to do what he did, living with motor neurons disease, is one, just inspiring. But his level of kind of abstract mathematical thinking in relation to stuff like black holes and general relativity is phenomenal. Like, he really is a titan in his field. Early in his life, he kind of left the door open for God, saying, you know, he didn't explicitly say that there is no God. If you read A Brief History of Time, there's that flavour there. But in one of his kind of later works, the Grand Design, he pretty clearly flat out says that there is no God. And of course, you know, the media will jump on that. They'll say, world famous physicist says that there is no God. He's proved it. There's your 6 o'clock bulletin. Move on to the next topic. And unfortunately, a lot of people in our culture just buy into that. They go, okay, well, it's, I kind of had this hunch it was right. Stephen Hawking's a really smart guy, so he's saying there's no God. So great, there's no God. Carry on. But let's just take a minute to unpack his kind of key argument of how there can be no God. And this comes to the idea of creation. How can you get something out of nothing? Hawking's quote, his kind of key sentence that he bases this whole idea on, goes like this: because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself. That's it. It's a very kind of pithy sentence. I'll say it again. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself. We'll unpack why it's silly in a second, but if that's the kind of core argument that people are buying into of why there's no God, I've got an equal quote, I reckon, from one of the great philosophers of our time. It goes like this: on Monday when the sun is hot, I wonder to myself a lot, now is it true or is it not, that what is which and which is what? On Tuesday when it howls and snows, the feeling on me grows and grows that hardly anybody knows if those are these or these are those. On Wednesday when the sky is blue and I have nothing else to do, I sometimes wonder if it's true that who is what and what is who. That was written by Winnie the Pooh, and to me makes more sense than what Stephen Hawking put forward as his key argument. When I first heard Hawking's argument, I knew it just smelt funny, but I didn't have the sophistication to understand why. John Lennox has three different levels of why that statement is just nonsense, really. Because there is a law of gravity, because you've got something, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing. There's so many things that are silly about that. And science itself doesn't have all the answers. So I thought I would spend just a real quick minute or two where we'll get down and dirty with some science. If we look at the kind of the two main pillars of modern physics, which kind of underpins everything, really, we've got general relativity, the top one, and quantum mechanics and the standard model. General relativity deals with all the big stuff, how matter on a really big scale interacts, how it interacts with space-time, how it curves it. It's a beautiful, elegant, amazing theory. I suggest you all go and read about it. It's actually 10 equations of nonlinear, partial, dynamical. It's just, I love it. Come around for a Friday night party and we'll do some maths. Like, I'm not kidding. Like, come around. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, and the standard model, so that's kind of everything that's not gravity related, and it's all the small stuff. So this is subatomic particles, force particles. It's an incredible theory. It's so incredible that it, I forget the levels of decimal places that these guys go to, but basically you have your theoretical physicists and then your experimental guys. These guys dream up what the idea should be. These guys go and test it. And if the two numbers match up, everyone has champagne and then they go, let's get even more decimal places. That's the kind of fun that these guys have. But it is phenomenal. It describes the way everything works. The only reason why we can have the kind of technology that we do now is because of this. It's an amazingly accurate description. But these two things really don't explain anything about what the heck actually is going on. They're amazing mathematical descriptions, sure, but kind of peel down, ask a few tricky questions at key physicists, at key quantum mechanics guys, and it kind of just gets a bit silly. Quantum mechanics is mostly about hardcore maths and probabilities, but throughout the entire history of quantum mechanics, everyone's kind of a bit uneasy about what this stuff actually means. There's a recent paper out by David Meerman, Cornell University in the States. This is in a published paper, and this is the kind of stuff he's writing. He's talking about quantum mechanics and the current state of it. We still lack any consensus about what one is actually talking about as one uses quantum mechanics. We do not understand the meaning of this strange conceptual apparatus, the mathematics of probabilities, that each of us uses so effectively to deal with our world. He even says in this published paper, what the hell are we talking about when we use quantum mechanics? It's a brilliant description, but no one knows what it actually is. It gets a bit silly when people do try and explain it. And even general relativity. So this is about gravity, the expansion of the universe, how it all plays. If you roll that backwards, which is what people have done, which is how we've got this idea of the Big Bang in the first place, go back 14 billion years, the best we can get to is that it was in a very, the universe was in a very, 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 very dense, hot speck. It says nothing about how that speck got there, which is, I think, the biggest question that science is trying to get a handle on. We start getting into these weird things like what Stephen Hawking said, that stuff comes from nothing. Some of the leading physicists at the moment are even arguing about redefining nothing, that nothing is a physical thing. It starts getting a little bit messy. So I just wanted to say that science is cool. I love it. This stuff is beautiful and elegant and amazingly descriptive, but get under the hood a little bit and it doesn't explain everything. There's big holes still to be filled. So for people that do say that the universe is totally explained and why do you need God, one point is, well, it's actually not totally explained. We've still got this problem of how the universe came to be in the first place. Okay, science is very cool, I do admit. Even if we do know a lot about the how, or even if we don't know a lot about the how, we know who and we know why a lot of the time. Science gives us very pretty pictures and videos, so I want to show you a couple now. I'm going to show you a real video. This isn't a Hollywood kind of CGI thing of our sun. I don't know if it's the same for you guys, but sometimes it's the case for me when you think about Sunday school stories and Bible stories, you think back to, say, the creation story, you think back to when you're in Sunday school, God created the world, there's 7 days, you've got little happy pictures of smiling animals in your head, and you kind of just casually think about it and you move on to the next thing. There's strategically placed fig leaves, all that kind of stuff. I wanted to just put the kind of the reality of what God has actually created front and centre. So just two quick examples here. I think you'll get the point that I'm trying to make. I'll just play it. So God created the world. Isn't it lovely? And then we move on to thinking about hot chips or something. This is the reality of what God actually did. One more example just to really ram the point home for you. That's the reality. I changed the music for the 9:30 service. I didn't want to blow out any hearing aids, but I thought I'd take the risk with you guys. That's what our God did. Our God, that's just our Son in the vastness of everything. He speaks that into existence. It's beyond our comprehension. And honestly, I think it's incredible that there is mystery and that there is incomprehension about God. To me, it just adds more credibility to God. Part of what mathematicians do a lot is you think about a problem and think about it in regard to the extremes, and then sometimes you might flip it upside down and think about the counterexamples. Can you imagine how disappointing it would be to find the kind of the wizard behind the curtain, so to speak, that if we knew everything about God, wouldn't that just be pretty lame? I'm sure it would be wowed and very cool for a little while, but I think we would move on to other things pretty quickly. Imagine if scientists came out this week and said, we've done it, we can explain everything, every single thing now. We'd all go, cool, that's amazing. And then next week we'd be thinking about, okay, so how do we earn more money? How do I just get back to my life? The point is that because there is mystery, because I can't understand everything, because no one can understand everything about God, to me that's just, that's reassuring. I like that idea of God. But I can see why it's uncomfortable for people. The truth. So kind of following some of these points about rationality and naturalism, reductionism, there is a place for God. If we follow those threads and we arrive at the conclusion that there is God, that's great. It's also a problem. I can see why people want to reject this idea, because it does mean then that we are personally accountable. We're answerable to that God. We can't just live our lives, even if we're trying to live good, we can't just live for ourselves. It means we need to respond seriously to the question of Jesus. Jesus is even more kind of counter-cultural. It means we need to actually look at that idea that C.S. Lewis had. Is Jesus Lord? Is he a liar? Or is he just a lunatic? There's historical accuracy that Jesus is legitimate. He was a guy that lived, that there's accuracy in the Bible. So if there is God, you know, we need to really respond with our life to that question. It means then that people I care about might miss out. They might miss out big time. It's kind of serious stuff when you, it's all nice to kind of play in theoretical land and maths and physics and have fun, but at the end of the day, it comes back to this question of Jesus. Do you accept him or not? There's no escaping it. We need to have an answer here. Okay, so finito, let's try and wrap this up. Thanks for sticking with me through equations and all of that kind of fun stuff. I know it's not for everyone. I love it. I'll happily read about how the universe is built and designed for hours and hours. But the idea that that is everything, that that's all there is, not a chance. I struggle to explain just how convicted I am that that's not the case. I know it's a very bold thing in a church to say that I believe that there's God. Cool. That's very risky of me. But I just want to have it flavour my existence, that I'm created. Jesus is God's son, and what's my response to that? How am I going to live my life? Responding that. And then can't you just feel it as well sometimes, just deep inside your soul? Surely our emotions, they're not just the result of some mindless, unguided process. The joy I feel when I see my children laughing hysterically, that's real. And it's not of this world. Music. How can music make me yearn? Sometimes it's not even happy and sad. Sometimes it's just this feeling that is felt. That's not just mathematical patterns in the frequencies of air pressure. It's creativity. It's given to us by a creative God. We must be made in his image, one, because he tells us that that's how we've been designed, but I can feel it. We're creative people that love and want to be in relationship with each other. That the universe is rational, describable, and beautiful. Surely it was designed by a designer. I just can't see how it wasn't. In a lot of ways, I actually haven't really changed much since year 7. I'd like to think I've matured a little bit, but probably not. I usually start every kind of talk that I give at work with, "Hi, my name is Luke. I'm a recovering hot chipaholic." And people kind of go, "Wait, what?" So I've kind of matured in some ways, but not really. I'm a little bit silly. But that talk I gave in year 7, the conclusion to that, I think is still valid. I haven't moved on from that. The answer is all along. It's in the Bible. God created everything. He built this universe. He spoke all of physics, all of science into play, and it was. He lovingly, carefully, sometimes with a laugh, probably more so for some of you than others, designed you, and he still loves you right now. Even just the idea of love. In order that love can be true and genuine between us, it means that he has given us intellect and wisdom to be able to make the choice to love of our own accord. Which the logical opposite of that, it means that we choose not to. We choose selfishly. We choose to forget God, which breaks his heart. But in order that we can love genuinely, that's how he's designed it. And then you know the last 2,000 years of this story, that God actually sent his son to become one of us. The physics of how that happens is, I'd love to know the answer, but it's beside the point. The point is that Jesus was here. He was a man. He died the death that we all deserved for our sin, so that that relationship could be restored with the Father. The evidence is kind of everywhere. Science points to it itself. The final point I want to make is that we should be pointing to it as well. Our lives can be part of that evidence that points to a creator. We can be little Jesuses that people see and they go, what is going on there with that person? That is evidence that there's something bigger at play here. So go and do that, yeah? I'm going to pray and then we might be able to squeeze in a song or two. We'll see how we go. Oh, Heavenly Father, thank you that you created us, that you are behind everything, that you have given us. You've given us minds to think for ourselves. You've given us creativity. And even though we stuffed it up, God, we just thank you so much that you sent your son Jesus for us to make that all right. We'll never know exactly how this all works. But the hope that you give, Father and Son and Holy Spirit, that we can spend eternity with you is incredible. And I want to be a part of it. So, Father, we thank you and we praise you. Amen.